Home Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. With the pandemic and police brutality, African Americans have had an extra heavy weight to carry. We'll hear about ways to ease the burden, especially when reminders never seem to stop. Plus, infiltrating an immigration detention center to help people get out. A new movie mixes drama and documentary filmmaking at the same time in the same scenes for a very unique viewing experience. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. Coming up in the show, we'll hear about a move to defund the LA school police. Plus, we'll check in on Project Room Key. That's the state's attempt to shelter thousands of homeless people to protect them from COVID-19. All that's coming up in about 30 minutes. But today, we're going to start with this.
When you get sad, he will. He will take care of you.
That sound there is from the funeral of George Floyd today in Texas. Floyd died last month after Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Footage of that killing and the protests it sparked are all over social media these days, and it's no surprise that a lot of people are struggling right now, especially people of color. So with so much racial strife happening right now, how do we as a community maintain our mental health during such a difficult time? And how do non-Black allies support their Black neighbors without adding to the emotional burden? Let's get some answers from Shamina Johnson. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist operating in mid-city Los Angeles, Carthay Square, to be exact. Shamina, welcome to Take Two.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Shamina, for many Black people, the death of George Floyd and the protests that are happening right now really just add on to generations of trauma that they already live with. 70 to 80% of your patients are Black. What are you hearing from them? What are they feeling right now?
What I'm hearing from a lot of my patients is a range of emotions from sadness, rage, fear, so many different emotions, and they're shifting from moment to moment. And it really does connect to different remembrances and memories, I think, of emotions that they've had in the past related to racism and trauma.
I think it was Will Smith who I saw on one of those talk shows. This is years ago. And he said something along the lines of racism isn't happening more. They're just being filmed more. And we can see them more.
Yes. With the social media, I think now it's just in your face. And I think you can't really turn away from it. But it has been happening for years. You know, one of the first things I remember, even growing up as a Black woman, you know, is recognizing, you know, racism and race and differences from a very early age. So it's been around for a long time.
And I guess that the understanding that psychology for Americans of African descent sometimes requires an extra level of that understanding, something that not all therapists are versed in. And that involves often finding ways to cope with the racism people face. Tell us a little bit about that. Why is that important?
I think it's important because so much about racism is the silence. I think a lot of people feel very uncomfortable talking about racism. A lot of people feel uncomfortable talking about white privilege and superiority and white supremacy, all of these different issues that I think evoke really uncomfortable feelings. And I will say that, you know, there's some therapists that are familiar, you know, with the impact of race on the lives of, you know, Black people, and I think are prepared to hear and explore and validate the narratives. And I think there are other therapists that may avoid, you know, the racial content, which only denies the existence of racism, and it impedes the healing process for Black people who really are trying to seek help and want to feel validated and acknowledge that it's a real thing. I think wherever there is silence surrounding the topic, it's like shame exists.
But there's no way right now an African American therapist could avoid this, right? I mean, if there's no way, right?
I would agree with you. Yes, I think having to confront your own feelings, you know, as an African-American therapist and what it means for you surrounding talking about the topic, it can bring up a lot of uncomfortable feelings, especially if you haven't confronted your own feelings about racism and maybe self-hatred or even shame.
Who does a therapist turn to, right, when they're dealing with some of the same things that their clients are dealing with?
I have my own therapist, so that's the person who I turn to that helps keep me, you know, on the straight and narrow. So
tell us, what are some of the things you recommend that your clients of color do right now? Not just to cope, but emerge ready to continue a lot of the conversations that have come up recently.
I would say that there are definitely harmful ways of coping with this, which I think would come in the form of like denial, you know, self-blame or aggression. I think some of the ways that you can like really confront this is, you know, seek social support, you know, within your community, family support, really close friends that you trust to be able to talk to. I think also limit your exposure to cues of racism, you know, signing off social media, even if it's just for a moment of time. Some people who may be religious or have spiritual practices, you know, find comfort in prayer. I think also participating in, you know, being a little bit restful and like relaxing activities. I think regardless of what you deploy, you know, racism is ongoing and it's an evolving process. And I think part of caring for yourself is self-preservation and knowing that this is a marathon that you have to deal with and not a sprint.
What about the focus on the voice of the people you see? Why is that important to make sure that's a focus?
What I've found is that when you're expressing and you're talking about racism, there's a lot of feelings that come up. It evokes feelings of shame, devaluation, sometimes anger, disappointment. And when you can allow and give someone the permission to have that voice, the pain of being a Black person in the United States gets recognized and it gets acknowledged. When the pain is unnamed and it's unrecognized, then it lacks validation. One of the things that keeps it like so silent, and I think makes it such a painful thing to confront, is that when you don't have someone who can validate that experience and say that, you know, you are right for feeling, you know, wronged or feel like there is racism, or you are absolutely right, then I think you can move towards a place of being able to seek treatment or support yourself or to come up with some type of resolve or solution to the issue. But when it's unnamed and unrecognized, then it gets repressed and you kind of organize your life around that. And I think giving someone the voice to express themselves helps validate it as a real issue in their life.
Talking to Shamina Johnson. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist operating in the Carthay Square area of Mid-City, Los Angeles. There's a lot of people out there, Shamina, who want to be there for their Black friends, for their neighbors, for their coworkers. But sometimes just getting texts from people that you haven't heard from in a long time is often a burden in itself. What would you recommend for people who want to be allies during this time?
First and foremost, I think respect their boundaries if they're not in the place to really have a conversation. I think respect that because this is a really painful process of not only carrying the emotional labor of dealing with your own emotions, but also dealing with the emotional labor of what's happening out in the world. The best thing that I would say is like, go on a listening tour. You know, just listen to your friend to try and deepen your understanding of the history. And I think the deep-rooted nature of racism in the United States. Another thing is, you know, understand your own personal relationship for someone who's non-Black to racism. How has your life been shaped around it? Reflect on the personal impact you have on the Black people in your immediate world, in your immediate circle. Take a moment to think about that. I think also develop a plan, you know, to enhance the wellness of Black and brown people in your world by, I think, speaking out against racism and or I think using unique skills that you have to facilitate, you know, Black wellness. And you can also take action with financial resources such as donating to, you know, anti-racist programs or volunteering. There are many ways to help people of color during this time.
I've always thought, Shamina, my grandpa used to tell me this all the time, that it's not enough to be well-meaning. You have to be well thought out in the things you do. And I think right now is a really good example of that because I think a lot of people have to understand, maybe sending this text to my friend that I haven't spoken to in 10 years, maybe that it might be well-meaning, but it's maybe not well thought out right now.
Yes, I was always told something very similar, that it's not your intentions in the moment that matters, because I think most people are well-intentioned. It's what you do with that in the moment. And I think taking a step outside of yourself and thinking about the other person and how it will impact them. Sometimes just sending a text of saying, I'm thinking about you and I care for you during this time, and reach out to me when you want to talk. That is just a little tidbit of saying, like, I'm thinking of you and I know this is hard for you. I've gotten several texts like that of friends and colleagues over the last several weeks. And that has been really nice to know that I have their support, whether I need it right now or I need it later.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned that the protests that have followed the death of George Floyd, hundreds of protesters have been arrested. We've seen videos of police using force on peaceful protesters. In some instances, people have felt unsafe around the people who they've been told are there to protect them. Is it possible, Shamina, that those interactions will affect those people long past today?
Oh, of course. Those residual feelings of trauma, of racial oppression, I think has a longer legacy than just the moment. And I think it will take time to really grieve and heal in that process. So even though it's happening right now, I can imagine, you know, even days, months, years from now, you know, you will have that memory in your body of what that means. And I think you want to give yourself the space to be able to process that so it doesn't become kind of entrenched or rigid. But definitely trauma such as this has reverberating effects.
You know, we talked about social media before, and yeah, and it's hard sometimes to get away from the news surrounding these protests. Lots going on all the time. New York State Legislature, for example, just passed a package of bills aimed at reforming policing. Here in Los Angeles, we're talking about diverting LAPD funds to community health and other programs. But even with all the positive developments out there, it can feel overwhelming sometimes, even for us, Shamina, in the news biz. So how can people find that balance, staying informed, staying active, but also taking care of yourself?
I would say one of the things that I've found that has been able to help me keep a little balance is while I'm staying informed is to really take care of myself. You know, it's not self-indulgence, you know, to take care of yourself is actually self-preservation. I think many times we look at caring for ourselves as like we have to go take a spa or do something really dramatic. Sometimes
and that feels selfish, does it? It feels selfish sometimes, right?
Yes. Yes, it does. But yeah. I think it's selfish in the way of self-preservation of like, I need to put the oxygen mask on myself first, you know, before I can get out there in the world and continue to be active and to participate, be proactive, you know, and to engage in these discussions. You have to kind of shore up your own emotional well and your own emotional resources before you can go out there again. And that is, you know, by recognizing and identifying if you need to rest or you need to put down the phone or if you just need to talk to a friend. All of these are ways to help replenish you, but also take the time that you need to relax.
Shamina Johnson is a licensed therapist in the Carthay Square neighborhood of Los Angeles. Shamina, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you.
This has been a challenging few weeks for so many reasons, but we'd like to hear from you about who out there gives you hope that change could be on the horizon. As protests against police brutality are carried out across the region and the country, who are those leaders and helpers who help you keep the faith? Please let us know. You can find a link to share your submission on Twitter. You can find us at Take Two. That's at Take Two. By the way, we're still in the midst of a pandemic. We're going to get a story on that coming up in just a bit on Take Two. But we also need your help because of it. We're running short on revenue, and we could really use your help. So if you got any room in your budget, please go to kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org. Any little bit goes a long way for us right now. All right, now back in April, Governor Gavin Newsom planned to move 15,000 homeless Californians into hotel rooms. And it sounded like it could be a win-win. No one was using the hotel rooms because of the virus, and homeless people could be inside and isolate in the rooms. It's called Project Room Key, and a couple of months in, they're short of their goal by 5,000. So is it a win or more of a bittersweet success story? That story is coming up next when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
How many roads must a man walk down before he's called a man? Tell me, how many seas must a white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Tell me, how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? No, the answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer blowing in the wind.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The Los Angeles Times today published a database of all the incidents of people killed by law enforcement in Los Angeles County since the year 2000. Now, there's something that could feel impersonal about statistics, but given the video of the killing of George Floyd in Minnesota and so many other videos of police aggression, these numbers become heavy with the lives they represent. Joining me to talk about what the findings tell us about the history and the present reality of police killings in L.A. County is L.A. Times staff writer Nicole Santa Cruz. Nicole, thanks for joining us on Take 2.
Hi, happy to join you.
Now, let's take apart the findings. Your report says that on average, police officers in the county kill 3 to 4 people each month. That's roughly 45 a year. Tell us about these people. Who are they?
Well, men account for nearly all of these deaths. Most of them are between the ages of 20 and 39. And we also see a little bit of populations being disproportionately impacted by police violence. So although Black people make up 8% of LA County's population, they represent about a quarter of law enforcement killings. White people make up about 26% of the population and are killed in about 19% of those incidents.
What about when it comes to Latinos?
So Latinos are kind of on track. They're proportionate with their population. So Latinos make up about 49% of LA County's population and represent about 53% of the deaths in our database.
Okay. Now, what about neighborhoods and cities? Which ones had the highest rate of police homicides?
So if we're looking at the numbers, killings by law enforcement occur across Los Angeles County. There's not really a specific neighborhood that stands out, but there are neighborhoods with the highest number of police killings. That would be Compton, Inglewood, and East Los Angeles. Those are also neighborhoods with a large number of Black and Latino residents.
Now, to be clear, we're talking about officers who work not just for LAPD, but for police departments all over the county and the sheriff's department as well. So do we know which departments were involved in these incidents?
For the most part, they are the officers involved in these incidents are from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and LAPD. Those are also the departments that are patrolling, you would probably say, the most amount of space in the county.
Now, you know, one of the things is language, a big part of how we report on deaths. And the headline of this article is police have killed 885 people in LA County since 2000. Nicole, wondering, what was the internal debate at the paper around using the word killed?
So we're using kill because the data comes from the coroner's office. So we haven't included anything that is maybe ruled an accident. We're including anything that is ruled a homicide. So homicides are when the coroner rules that the death of a person is at the hands of another. So that's kind of where the word killing comes from.
Nicole, what are the circumstances of these killings? Like, what was the situation? Was there a chase involved? Any details you can give us?
Well, it varies. Usually it's the result of a traffic stop, and then maybe someone running or not obeying police orders, a frequent kind of line in a lot of news releases that law enforcement will put out about these killings is that they didn't obey law enforcement orders. Sometimes that's up to dispute. A lot of these killings are gunshots. So 865 people have been shot by police since 2000. Sometimes they're armed, sometimes they're not. We don't really have specific statistics regarding the number armed versus unarmed.
Now, how do the deaths happen? What weapons or methods have the police used that have turned out to be most lethal?
Mostly, these are all gunshot victims. There's about 12 other cases that are ruled homicides by the coroner's office that would be due to like tasers or another method of death. We only have one blunt force death in this database, and that is from a vehicle colliding with a person.
What about restraints? Any indication of if restraints are involved?
It's fairly rare for a restraint to be involved, and then the coroner is going and ruling it a homicide. Usually I believe the coroner rules that an accident. So the restraints, it's not really part of our how we take the data, how we track the data.
We're talking to Nicole Santa Cruz, LA Times staff writer. Nicole, how often are police prosecuted for these killings?
Prosecutions are incredibly rare in these situations. Since 2000, only two members of law enforcement have been prosecuted for an on-duty shooting by the LA County District Attorney's Office.
Of all the others, is there any consequence or any punishment that's revealed?
Since 2000, two officers have been charged as a result of shooting a civilian while on duty. We have one case that's still in process, or moving through the criminal justice system. So in 2018, a Los Angeles sheriff's deputy was charged with voluntary manslaughter after a man was killed at a Norwalk gas station. And then that was the first time that we saw charges in a on-duty shooting since 2000, when an LAPD officer was accused of shooting an unarmed motorist four times in the back during a dispute over a traffic citation. That officer, Ronald Orozco, pleaded no contest in that case to a felony charge of shooting at an occupied motor vehicle. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison.
Nicole, when it comes to this job, I mean, you're reporting on people dying. I'm wondering what this does to you. I mean, you have to turn something off to try and just get your job done, or does all this weigh on you somehow?
Well, I've been doing it now for about 7 years, and it definitely weighs on you, but I think that the work is so important and so crucial sometimes to our national conversation that it's also incredibly fulfilling work. Talking to people on the streets, talking to families who have had their loved ones killed by law enforcement is also incredibly fulfilling. There's a lot of strength there. And I think that that kind of helps me deal with the weight of the subject matter that I'm covering.
Yeah. Now, you write the homicide report for the LA Times, so you track these instances in an ongoing way. Wondering what role do you think that we in the media play in how these cases of police homicides are reckoned with, both by departments and by the citizens of LA County?
I think that in the past, the media sometimes doesn't focus on these cases. Sometimes we ignore them. I think now it's great to see an increased or renewed attention paid to these types of killings, because I think it undoubtedly helps us kind of figure out what to do next.
That's LA Times staff writer Nicole Santa Cruz. Nicole, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. At the onset of the pandemic here and the stay-at-home orders that followed, the big worry was about a possible spread among the homeless, especially those sleeping on the streets. Enter Project Roomkey, the state's attempt to shield thousands of people from COVID-19 by sheltering them in hotel rooms. It hasn't achieved all of its goals, but it's shown that with political will and money, things can be done differently. KPCC's homelessness reporter Matt Tinoco has a story.
The past few weeks have been the longest time Karen Bierman has lived in one place for some time. She's grateful for the room.
Because I'm not, like, in my car.
The 48-year-old from Lakewood is disabled. She copes with chronic pain and, thanks to a lupus diagnosis, is immunocompromised. She's skirted on the edge of homelessness for the last 2 years, and like many others who plunge into poverty, it all started with a trip to the hospital and mounting medical bills.
And by the time I felt better, I looked at my finances and found out that I didn't have finances that I thought I had.
She's mostly been staying in rented rooms and cheap hotels, the most recent on a voucher she obtained through the City of Long Beach's homelessness program. Then in April, Karen heard about Project Roomkey. It prioritizes homeless people who are older or have serious underlying health conditions like lupus. So she started calling everyone from her case manager to government officials to see if she could get a room.
So I emailed the mayor and emailed the senator, and then it started happening.
Soon, she and her two black Labrador service dogs moved into a Holiday Inn in Long Beach.
she's pretty happy.
They have a nurse that comes in with breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They take your temperature to make sure that, you know, you're not infected somehow.
Project Roomkey originated in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic, when an alarming model by the state's health department predicted coronavirus could sweep through the state's homeless population. It warned 12,000 could end up in the hospital, overwhelming the state's medical system. It prompted Governor Newsom to announce the unprecedented step of moving thousands of homeless people into hotel rooms.
Let me be specific to what we call Project Roomkey, which is this program, 15,000 units that we will identify and procure under this new FEMA framework.
In ordinary times, quickly sheltering that many people would be virtually impossible. But the Federal CARES Act authorized spending FEMA funds to protect the homeless, which is where Project Roomkey is getting most of its money. Newsom's goal was to shelter 15,000 people statewide, though from the beginning, there were doubts about whether those goals could be reached. This is L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, also in early April.
These are stretch goals. Right now, I hope that we can get into the thousands of people in those hotel and motel rooms in the next 2 to 3 weeks.
Garcetti was right. It was a stretch. Today, there are about 9,400 rooms occupied statewide, about two-thirds of Newsom's original goal. It's not for a lack of trying, though. The logistics challenge is just enormous. Hesitant insurance companies, leasing and then preparing hotels, staffing doctors, nurses, social workers, and security at each site. In L.A., that work is led by the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, or LASA, and dozens of other nonprofit agencies. They tapped into the expertise of L.A. County's Office of Emergency Management, but they still had to work out how to do all of this at scale, quickly, for the first time.
It was a massive lift.
Heidi Marston is LASA's director. She says that while the startup was slow, things are moving faster now.
But it's like a choreographed dance now. When we're opening a hotel, everyone knows exactly what they're supposed to do.
But there are still a lot of unknowns, particularly about what will happen to people in hotels once the 3-month leases are up. Because technically, all the people who moved indoors are still homeless. That makes Larry Haynes, who directs the service provider Mercy House, worried about potential blowback in the coming months if the public questions whether the money will make a difference in the long term.
You really didn't spend money on homelessness. You spent money on a public health concern.
In context of the coronavirus pandemic, Haynes thinks it makes sense. But was it the best use of money?
The most diplomatic answer I could give to that is the jury is still out.
And the jury's still out for Karen Bierman, too. The lease on her room expires June 30th. When I asked her if she knew where she's going next...
Well, as of right now, I have no idea.
She says her case manager keeps dodging her calls.
I don't have housing by June 30th. What happens then?
It's a good question. Covering homelessness, I'm Matt Tinoco.
All right, we've heard calls to defund the LAPD, and it's got some people thinking about other police departments to eliminate. For example, the Los Angeles School Police Department. That's 400 officers that serve the Los Angeles Unified School District. Now, the teachers' union is behind the idea, but what would happen if a school needs a police officer on campus right away, immediately, to, say, de-escalate a dangerous situation? That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Gotta change around here. Gotta change around here. Can't go on this way. Things gotta change around here. Say it loud, say it clear. Things gonna change around here. Fingers on the trigger around here. Fingers on the trigger around here. Bullets flying, mothers crying. We gotta change around here. Get it straight. Be sure that you hear things gonna change around here.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Ian Martinez. For decades, the Los Angeles Unified School District has commanded its own independent police force, one of the largest school police departments in the nation. But the district's powerful teachers union, United Teachers Los Angeles, recently voted 35-2 to decrease funding to the department. For more on why and what this means, we have KPCC's education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Welcome back, Kyle.
Hi, A.
Now, you were there yesterday when UTLA President Alex Caputo-Pearl made that big announcement. What's the end game?
Well, the end game is not just a decrease in funding, but a complete cut of funding. That's what the union at least wants. Whether or not this can be enacted is sort of another story. Now, some of this is just sort of actually kind of like internecine teachers union politics. The union's call that we're talking about is that the union's leadership, the UTLA board of directors, voted by an overwhelming margin, by 35-2, to endorse a proposal that would call on LAUSD to strip all funding from the school police department. Now, this doesn't become the union's formal position until it goes on to the union's House of Representatives, which is this formal, this representative body of 250 different union members. They would have to approve it. There's probably, going to be significant debate within the union about whether to even move forward with this as the union's official position. But if they do approve this, and I think that the announcement alongside Black Lives Matter activists, as well as other labor unions yesterday, associating themselves with the sort of movement against police that we're seeing in the wake of the death of George Floyd. I think a lot of this, is UTLA positioning itself to align its considerable political and organizational resources against the LA School Police Department. And I asked the president, Alex Caputo-Pearl of UTLA, why now? Why do this? And he said that it's the movement on the streets that is forcing students forcing the union to reconsider its stance. Here's what he said during the rally yesterday.
Schools should be places of learning, should be places of love, should be places of caring that does not depend on policing. This movement now is forcing us to reimagine that.
All right, Kyle, so the proposal is to take money out of LA school police budget and fund more social services in the schools. What are the specifics on that?
Well, there aren't a ton of specifics connected to the union's proposal. This is, of course, just a policy demand rather than a proposal of how to implement it. And, you ask Alex Caputo-Pearl, what do you do with the $75 to $80 million that goes into the school police department budget every year, which we should say is a very small portion of the school district's overall budget. And he says, well, that should go into social workers, into counselors, into other social services that the school district provides, as well as things like smaller class sizes, maybe more campus aides. It's all a little bit undefined at this point. But what they're calling for is that I think that they're echoing the concerns that you hear from activists, which is that school police on campus do more harm than good. And at a time when the school district is considering significant budget cuts, potentially could face budget cuts because state revenues have dropped off, as we've talked about numerous times on this on these airwaves here, that it doesn't make sense to continue funding school police at current levels when the core mission of the school district could face potential cuts.
Now, Kyle, this move comes after we've been seeing a trend all over the country along this vein. In the last week, the Minneapolis, Portland, and Chicago school districts have voted to cut ties with local police departments. What sets LAUSD apart?
Well, I think you mentioned this earlier, and I think that it's worth underlining that this isn't just LA Unified, contracting with, LAPD and slapping a new patch on their arms. This is a completely different, independent police force that is operated from within LAUSD. LA school police officers are LAUSD employees. And not only that, they're unionized employees. So this is a rare instance of a labor union, a kind of brother labor union within LAUSD, turning on another labor union and suggesting that it shouldn't exist. And so I think what happened in Minneapolis and Portland, what activists are calling for in places like Chicago and New York, are the cutting of ties with local police police departments. It's essentially just like saying we don't want to pay for this contract anymore. We're gonna terminate this contract. But you can reassign the police officers that had been once school police officers, school resource officers. You can just reassign them somewhere else. In LAUSD, what would be involved is actually the dismantlement, the layoff, you know, parting ways with, you know, police officers, with people who are district employees. They could no longer continue to work for the school district as employees. So that is sort of what would make this task in LAUSD a lot more complicated.
Talking to KPCC's education reporter Kyle Stokes. So it could be argued that this really has been a long time coming. In recent years, UTLA has actually sided with activists who oppose the LA school police. So Kyle, remind us briefly when that happened and what was it all about?
Yeah, in recent years, we've heard a lot about the random search policy in LAUSD. This is the district's policy of randomly searching students in high schools and middle schools every single day for weapons and other contraband, drugs. The school police did not conduct these searches, but they supported the policy of having administrators conduct these searches. They saw it as an important preventative measure. The union sided with student activists and other civil rights groups that opposed these random searches for a number of different reasons, including that students felt sort of criminalized by these, felt like targets within their own communities. The police association and the school police department wanted to keep that policy in place. They did not ultimately succeed in keeping that wanding, as it's called, policy still in place. There's a more recent movement that the teachers union had voiced support for to ban the use of pepper spray on campuses. So UTLA has opposed school police on different policy issues in the past, but they have not gone so far have explicitly said that they do not want to dismantle the school police department, but that could be changing with this move.
Now, about this latest proposal, defund the school police. You got some reaction from the president of the LA School Police Association. What did he have to say?
Yeah, Gil Gomez. And he, first of all, just acknowledged that that there are significant, you know, the protesters are right about systemic racism. And, he said over and over again that obviously there are huge disparities in incomes and outcomes for students of color in this country, for people of color in this country, and that shapes how they interact with police. And to that extent, he says that, you know, there's definitely a problem. But he also, is really critical of, you know, one union turning on another. And he also says that the school police department is specifically trained to avoid a lot of the circumstances that have garnered a lot of criticism for police around the country in recent years. Here's what Gil Gomez had to say.
We are the department in the future in many aspects. The number one thing that a police officer is supposed to do is de-escalate. Our officers are the best in de-escalation. They don't even know it.
All right, so Kyle, you mentioned how it's not a done deal yet. The board of directors for UTLA voted for this, though. What are the next steps?
Well, I think the next steps, you know, if the union were to call for this, it would all kind of come down to the school board budget and whether or not the school board members are willing to vote for this. There was a four vote block that previously, I mentioned that random search policy. They had previously voted in favor of rolling back that random search policy that the police had favored. That block, you know, it's not clear whether it exists to completely strip down the school district's budget. There are some steps that the school district could take, potentially limiting, going forward with limits on pepper spray, maybe not filling vacancies within the police department. There may be some, you know, sort of smaller steps that the school district might be able to take in the short term. It's going to be a much taller order to completely roll back funding for the school police department, at least in the near term. And the question is sort of I think it depends on what happens with this activist movement, whether or not activists are able to keep up the pressure, because this is going to be a long fight if what they're hoping for is the complete defunding of the school police department in LA.
KPCC's education reporter, Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, people don't walk up and knock on the door on an immigration detention center looking for a family or friend especially if the ones asking claim or let it slip out that they are undocumented. Now, that is unless that person is actually trying to infiltrate an immigration detention center to help people get out. A new movie mixes drama and documentary filmmaking at the same time in the same scenes for a very unique viewing experience. We're going to talk to the filmmakers, the directors of The Infiltrators coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. The new movie, The Infiltrators, uses both documentary-style filmmaking and scripted scenes with actors, and at times it even blends the two. And I have to say, it's really one of the most innovative films I've seen in a long time. The documentary part of the film follows a group of dreamers, young adults brought to the U.S. as kids who are still in this country because of DACA. They're advocates for law-abiding immigrants who get arrested and put in detention centers and threatened with deportation. Now, in the film, two dreamers get deliberately arrested themselves so that they can infiltrate the center and work with detainees from the inside. Now, since the filmmakers couldn't follow those who got detained, they turned to actors to show that side of the story in the movie. The Infiltrators made its premiere at Sundance earlier this year. Then, because of the coronavirus, it got released on streaming. And joining me now are the co-directors, Cristina Ibarra and Alex Rivera. Alex, Cristina, welcome to Take Two.
It's great to be here.
It's great to hear the last names pronounced correctly.
Well, that's what I'm here for now. Okay, now, The Infiltrators is set in 2012, and the documentary portion of it was shot then because you two were filming a group called the National Immigrant Youth Alliance based in Broward County, Florida at the time. What were they attempting to do?
Early in the Obama administration, dreamers were being deported. And this group stood up and took kind of incredible risks. First, it was to demand the DREAM Act. And then after that, it was to try to stop deportations generally. And the group had developed what they thought of as pretty good tactics to stop deportations. And so they decided the best place to do that is inside of a detention center. So the story of the Infiltrators follows these young activists when they get apprehended by Border Patrol on purpose to go into a detention center to get people out.
And quickly, tell us about the three people you focused on.
So we have Mo, who is on the outside of the detention center, and then we have the two infiltrators. Marco and Vidi work with Mo as they strategize to try to keep Claudio Rojas from being deported. That's the father of one of their friends.
And the thing about it is, you know, they'd literally walk to the front door of the detention center and pretend to be looking for someone else, then kind of accidentally reveal that they're undocumented, thereby getting arrested. So let's listen to a clip of Mohammed coaching Viridiana to get arrested by dressing and speaking like what a Border Patrol agent might imagine an undocumented immigrant looks and sounds like.
Mr., I'm here to turn myself in.
No,
too formal.
Too dreamer.
I'm here.
He's gotta be Spanish.
I here to turn self in.
I can almost compare it to a theater play. Mo being the director, Marco and I being actors.
Alex, how much coaching was involved?
You know, once these young undocumented activists decided to get detained by the Border Patrol, which is a very strange decision to make, right, they found it actually difficult and would go up to the Border Patrol and they'd be like, well, who are you? What are you doing? Don't tell me you're illegal. Go away. But they ultimately felt like they needed to be profiled and to sort of fit the stereotype of an undocumented immigrant in order to get taken in. And so that scene we just heard was Vidi kind of practicing her role, you know, and both her and Marco, it took them multiple attempts to get in to the detention system.
Yeah, and Christina, one of the things that was interesting, especially when it comes to Mohammed, he's kind of like George Clooney's character in Ocean's 11, the ringleader of this group. So tell us about him. Who is he and how did you guys find him?
He is a gay Iranian activist. He's undocumented. And we found him because he was one of the first people to really innovate this type of civil disobedience where undocumented people risked their own deportation by going into John McCain's office and demanding that he support the DREAM Act. He was successful, and then he applied that strategy multiple times.
Okay, so, Alex, once Marco and Vidi manage to get themselves arrested and be put in these detention centers, what's their mission when they're in there?
They go into detention because they feel like they have knowledge that detainees need. We're used to some basics in the criminal justice system of the Miranda rights, a court-appointed attorney if you can't afford one, a trial by a jury of your peers. None of that happens in immigrant detention. They don't get court-appointed lawyers. There's no trial. When an immigrant has contact with the immigration system, the agent themselves, they can decide to keep you for 2 days, for 2 weeks, for 2 years. The entire immigrant detention system runs on discretion, and it's that discretion, that political will, that the infiltrators go in to attack.
We're talking about the film The Infiltrators with directors Alex Rivera and Cristina Ibarra. Now, from a filmmaking perspective, you two are following this group and have footage of them working the phones, as we heard, getting ready to infiltrate. But once Marco and Vidi go in, you guys don't have the camera on them anymore. So, Cristina, how did you figure out how to fill in the gaps in that part of the story?
It was a process. We explored so many different ideas. Alex likes to draw. We explored drawings. We explored mixed media with our archival footage. And so the creativity of the activists themselves really led us to think about actors. We were inside the detention center that it was recreated. It was scripted. It was not documentary footage.
Right. When people are watching that part of the movie, that part is completely, as you mentioned, scripted with actors. But then there's the real people that are interacting at the same time. So whenever the actors would be calling out to their colleagues on the outside, the film would shift to reveal the real life responses, and then it would jump back and forth. So I want to get an example of that so everyone can kind of feel that. So let's listen to a clip of actor Marco and the real life Mo trying to figure out how to keep a detained named Benny from being deported.
They're deporting Benny. His flight leaves tonight.
Yeah, I know. He just called his wife. Hey, can you please try and find out what time his flight is?
Hey, Claudio. ¿Puedes chequear que no se va su vuelo?
Déjame intentarlo.
Okay, but what I tell him?
So tell him to try and refuse to board, like do the same.
So Alex, right there, you got an actor talking to a real person, moving the story forward. I mean, how did this help with that? I mean, to not to have to go back in time and then catch back up.
So this all came out of this, you know, the creative crisis of not being able to see inside of the detention center. Those are spaces filmmakers are not allowed to go, journalists aren't allowed to go. And so to visualize it, we had to get creative and use actors. And then once we started to do that, because we had observational footage of the campaign outside the detention center in real time, when we started to work with this recreated material, it became really exciting because I think we're used to movies that have reenactments where it's like you see somebody in an interview saying, well, when I was a kid or when I was in jail, and you kind of flash back to the past. But we had something else, which was a ticking clock, and we had our verite footage in the moment and the ability to cross-cut simultaneous story time between the world of documentary with the recreated material that's kind of depicting what was happening that night.
Eventually, the warden of the detention center found out what Marco and Vidi were doing. And it's up to you two if you guys want to reveal what happened. I'm going to leave that decision up to you guys. But what were you guys thinking when you heard that the jig was up in real life?
Yeah, I mean, the group of activists were incredible and I think really deserve a place in history because they did things that no one had done before, and the actions that they undertook, a lot of people, even inside the immigrant rights movement, said you can't do it. But I will say this, I mean, I don't think there's been another movie that shows people refusing to leave a jail or a detention center.
Yeah, and then, you know, for Vidi to, you know, be standing up to officers who are trying to eject her, I mean, she's reminding everyone of all of the people that she came for. She's like, I'm not leaving without them. It's very moving.
You know, as I mentioned, okay, Infiltrators is set in 2012. That's an election year for President Obama. Now, his record on immigration varies depending on who you ask. Immigrant advocates have called him deporter-in-chief because he deported 2.5 million people, while enforcement hawks feel that maybe he failed to do as much as he could by focusing on immigrants with criminal records and recent unauthorized border crossers. Alex and Christina, considering how close you two were to all that back in 2012, which one of those two holds the most water?
If you talk to an immigrant or an immigrant family that's going through a deportation, what it starts to look like and what it looks like to me is a kidnapping. You're taking a family that is seeking the same thing all of us are, work, freedom, dignity, opportunity, hope, and who want to be here. And you're putting one of those people in handcuffs, forcing them onto a plane or a bus, sending them somewhere they don't want to go.
Where
they could be killed and taken away from their family. So to me, watching the detention system and the deportation machine break apart families in 2010 and 2011 and 2012, all those years, has a lot of hurt.
Yeah, and when we're searching for solutions, it's important to turn to people who have the most experience. And in this case, with this issue, it happens to be people who are undocumented. So let's hear that voice. Let's bring it to the table to come up with solutions.
That's Alex Rivera and Christina Ibarra, and their film is called The Infiltrators. Alex, Christina, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And The Infiltrators is available on iTunes, Amazon, and cable video on demand. All right, if you missed any part of Take Two and are wondering, well, where can I find Take Two? Where is Take Two available? Well, wherever you get your podcasts, there we will be waiting to be heard by you. You missed a good one today, so just go right on over and get it, download it, and figure it out, and listen. Listen to Take Two as often as you can. We're on at 2 o'clock every single day. All right, if you also want to follow us on social media, we're there as well. You can find us on Twitter, at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well. A Martinez LA. That's A Martinez LA. That is good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. And also, by the way, if you do have room in your budget, we would love it if you supported KPCC. Just go to kpcc.org and give whatever you can to support what you get here on this radio station each and every day. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2.